when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Coming up on today's episode, a bit of a history lesson. Harold Wilson described as the winner in a new book about the former Prime Minister by the current Labour frontbencher, Nick Thomas Symonds. He joins me, really interesting chat about what it was that Harold Wilson had that made him so successful, and lessons for Keir Starmer too. So that's coming up in just a moment. First though, as ever, on a Tuesday, we kick off with our columnist panel. It's Finkelwich, and it's a very special one because it's Danny Finkelstein's birthday.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelwich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Yes, it's Tuesday, so it must be Finkelwich. We say a very good morning to Daniel Finkelstein. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Matt.
And a very happy birthday to Daniel Finkelstein.
Thank you, Matt.
60 today. Happy birthday, Danny.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
And good morning to David Aronovich. Morning, David.
Good morning and happy birthday, Danny.
Now, if you had both been in the studio, David was fully prepared to jump out of a cake, but you're not, so that's not happening. The 6-foot cake we'd had built is now being dismantled.
I have been at a birthday party where someone jumped out of a cake.
Of course you have.
Michael Ashcroft had a birthday party in which Cliff Richard sang congratulations while Denise Van Outen jumped out of the cake.
Of course it did. Have you ever been at a party where someone's jumped out of a cake, David?
No, I don't mix in the same circles as Danny, clearly, and therefore my exposure to billionaires has been pretty kind of minimal.
Well, if you've ever burst out of a cake, do get in touch in the usual ways, 8722, starting message with the word Times, etc., etc. As we are talking about your birthday, Danny, let's talk about you'd suggested your earliest political memory. So let's wind the clock back. What is your earliest political memory?
So my earliest, I just thought it would be quite interesting, think about ages. My earliest political memory is Robert Kennedy's assassination in June of 1968. So I was 5. Which is quite a geeky political memory.
That's quite a geeky.
I do remember being 11, and my French teacher saying that Giscard d'Estaing had been elected President of France, and that he used to be France's defense minister. And I put my hand up and said, I think he was France's finance minister, sir. you thought he was happy with that answer, but he wasn't actually very impressed.
So you're a little bit older, David. So what's your earliest political memory?
Well, I think it must be my dad and I were walking down Downing Street. And don't ask me why. And my dad suddenly turned around and said, the Prime Minister lives there. And I said, and who's that? And he said, Harold Macmillan. And that's all I remember. But I mean, of that particular incident, but I do remember.
That's quite a good story, though.
And the other one is when my dad got the new Communist Party van, which was a black van with a large loud hailer on the top of it, which was so that he could do slogans from it. And somebody put some placards on the side of it. And I can't remember what the placards were, but I think that counts as a political memory.
That's a sad idea.
I was very excited by that car.
I think that definitely counts as a political moment. Well, I mean, I'm slightly younger. My sort of earliest political memories are probably the tally in the kitchen being on for the budget, and my parents following it very closely, particularly what was happening to booze and fags. That was the sort of. So I was trying to work out Nigel Lawson, probably.
Were you born, Matt?
82. I mean, for benefit of anyone who wants to get in touch, it's my 40th birthday in a couple of weeks. So yeah, probably Nigel Lawson. So that was definitely a memory. And then sort of I definitely remember the sort of the hoo-ha over Thatcher leaving Downing Street.
Well, it was 100% Nigel Lawson. If you already remember Thatcher leaving and you remember the budget before, and you were born in 82, then it would have been him.
Yeah, so there we are. There we are. That dates us all. It dates us all.
You pair of young things.
I really did this item in order that somebody would say that, really. When you're on the day that you're 60, you need someone to say that.
David to come along and say, oh, you young whippersnapper, Danny.
Well, I was just thinking, Danny has to, you know, he's not got long to wait before his hair goes as grey as mine.
But I'd be lucky if my hair, because the thing is, you've got a full head of yours. My hair won't go grey, it's just sort of falling out.
That was exactly the compliment I was wishing for.
Yeah, it's not so much grey as transparent in Danny's case. Let's share your earliest political memories. 8722 start with the word times and all the usual ones. In terms of politics happening right now, Liz Truss being a no-show, is it understandable? Yeah, she's pulled out of the BBC interview that was planned for tonight. I mean, she's not been on Times Radio at all, which she said that was on a couple of weeks ago. He's done far more, but then I suppose he had less to lose. Does it matter at this stage, Danny? She could be prime minister literally in a week's time. It doesn't appear to want to appear in front of the cameras.
I'm very interested in the duality of this. So first of all, obviously it is in the electorate's interest and in the interests of democracy that she should appear on this programme. And I disapprove strongly of the fact that she's not doing that. But I also note that this disapproval, or indeed any concern about it at all, isn't that widely shared. And it won't do her any political damage whatsoever. I think the calculation that it will do her less political damage not to appear on it than to appear on it and do badly is probably correct. When I'm advising politicians, or when I have been advising politicians in the past, my advice is always to start by doing the right thing, start by saying the right thing. You'll never be ashamed of doing that. The truth is, if you advised her to do the right thing in these circumstances, you might be giving her poor strategic political electoral advice. And that, I think, is something that all journalists have to think about. So, you know, if you look at 50 or 60 years ago, the beginnings of these sorts of interviews, they were clearly almost comically respectful. But it is also the case that doing an interview now, you can understand why a politician doesn't want to do it. Even though I think they should do it, that is not actually a consideration for them. So what I think we as journalists have to consider is what is actually in it for the person that we are inviting. I think one of the concepts behind Times Radio was that you can get a lot out of people whilst they still get an opportunity to put their own point as well. And therefore you can get a better guest and probably more out of it for both the viewers and the people who are appearing. But I only put it because I think it's quite an interesting dilemma and I wanted to know what David thought.
Yeah, I mean, in general, if it's a toss-up between what's in Liz Truss's interests and what's in the electorate's interest, I kind of tend to come down on the side of the electorate. Sure. And so consequently, my view is that she should have done it and she should have made the statement, both to her advisors and to the country, by doing it, by saying, no, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be held accountable, though I don't doubt that Danny is mostly right when he says that a large proportion of the electorate wouldn't have taken any notice. Although I do wonder whether aspects of this don't kind of bleed through if you've already got a bit of a reputation as not a great performer or something like that. But then I haven't actually peered too deeply into the polls about what the public currently thinks about Liz Truss, if indeed they think anything about her. But Matt, you're a great enthusiast for those kind of political interviews, particularly the Sunday lunchtime program, because you did a whole series about it.
Yeah.
And actually, it's always been a lot more difficult than people imagine to get politicians to agree to appear on them as a matter of being accountable. They simply do not see that being on these interviews, on these programs, is a matter of accountability in the way that some of us journalists do and some other people do. They see it as purely being a matter of whether it's the most effective way of getting your message across, getting yourself out of difficulty, or becoming elected. And it is as functional as that, and frankly, has not really been that different over the years. And all the times I was working at Weekend World, for example, I don't think I found that many interviewees, political interviewees, who thought, I'm going to go on this because it's really important that I show my face to the electorate as a matter of principle. I don't think I ever saw that.
Yeah, I would add that, of course, the problem with Weekend World was it was on a weekend. So for a lot of politicians, Sunday is one of the few days that they try and put by and say, well, that is going to be for my family. And it's difficult then if there are interviews and they have to travel into town and do them. And so that's an additional feature of weekend interviews. But, you know, the problem is, you say, and I completely, very strongly agree with you, that Liz Truss holding herself as accountable is in the interests of the electorate. Therefore, you and I think she should do it. But the question she's considering is it in my interests?
Yeah.
And one of the things that we have to consider when we're considering how to attract people to come onto these programs and then be held to account is what is in it for her. And the reason we have to think that is otherwise she won't do it. And it would be fine if the electorate then said, if you won't do it, that's a disgrace. The truth is, the electorate asked them, the electorate might think that, but most people are not that interested in, you know, the schedule of a television program that doesn't happen. So my view is that we have to think as journalists, how are we going to ensure that these people find it in their interests as well as the electorates to appear on these programs? And you may say, well, that's not the right question. Well, then Liz Truss will reach her own answer.
But there are only two ways of doing that, or two things, ways of convincing people, politicians, that they should do it. The first is that maybe this law you've adumbrated will change, and that actually the electorate will think very badly of them if they don't. So that would constitute a reason for doing it. The other way is to tell them, yes, it's very much in your interest because X, Y, and Z will happen, and therefore, and I'm sort of rather chary about that, because that creates a kind of coziness between what we're supposed to be doing and what they're supposed to be doing, which is rather problematic. And so I don't actually have an answer to this overall, other than for us to stress the accountability question in the same kind of way, semi-fictional way, that we've tended sometimes to talk about manifestos, although neither you or I are great fans of manifestos.
I tell you the answer to it. The answer is to assign more prominence to the appearances in Parliament, which are compulsory. One of the reasons we have a parliamentary democracy is that, rather than a presidential one, is that such appearances in Parliament and being held to account is compulsory. And John Bercow, I think, actually, you know, among good things that he did was to extend a period of time that a prime minister might be asked, for example, about their appearance at a summit so that they could be questioned by MPs. You might consider in the House of Commons whether members of Parliament might be able to add follow-up questions, because beyond the opposition leaders, MPs aren't always able to do that, and therefore you don't get a high standard of inquiry. But one of the answers to this is simply to accord, you know, more media attention, newspaper attention, for example, and other media attention to proceedings in Parliament, because the appearances there are compulsory.
And I suppose the thing, you're right, the calculation that Liz Truss is making right now is that the downside of mucking up is greater than the current downside of being seen to go AWOL. But that might change. And I was quite struck, actually, on Friday, the reaction to the fact that we didn't see her at all on the day that we found out about the energy bills. You know, Boris Johnson appeared, Nadeem Zahawi appeared, Rishi Sunak appeared. And you just think, if her solution, if her instinct, whenever there's anything like that comes along, is to go AWOL, you know, is that just because she's sitting tight during a leadership contest, or is that her instinct full stop?
I think it probably is. Look, she has a particular weakness. with these interviews, definitely. I remember that years and years ago when Liz Truss had just been elected as a backbench MP, and I've always quite liked her as a person. I think she's actually quite an intelligent individual and, you know, by all accounts was quite good as a minister. But I appeared immediately after on some, you know, regional radio programme. We were at a party conference in a sort of funny hotel room, and she was on before me, and she got herself into all sorts of trouble by her answer. And I thought to myself, my goodness, if you become a prominent politician, you're going to get yourself into real trouble with these interviews. But you know, she shrewdly, on a very crude political level, understands that. By the way, obviously, I think the Conservative Party members ought to take that into consideration in making their own vote. And it was part of my consideration in determining that I'd vote for Rishi Sunak. But I understand why she's made the decision she's made. And speaking as a journalist, as well as, you know, a sort of political operator, we have to think, well, what is the best way of trying to ensure that we can answer the questions we want and hold people to account? There's no point having a kind of fantasy view of what she ought to do if politically the calculation is she doesn't need to.
I don't want to repeat what I said earlier too much. Insofar as you create a little bit of weather in the electorate about the nature of accountability, and you might be able to create a bit, I think it is actually quite important that where somebody like Liz Truss has agreed in advance that she was going to do something, and the other candidate agreed to do it, possibly partially on that condition as well, I think it's important to point out when she doesn't keep that promise.
I think it is totally wrong she didn't do it, and I'm all for amplifying the fact that she's refused to do this and urging Conservative members or voters to take this into consideration in making their decision. It's rightly part of their decision. I'm just not that sanguine about my chance of persuading very many to share that concern. Even if, for instance, there was a big amount of pressure on Boris Johnson during the last general election to appear on the Andrew Neil programme, Dominic Cummings explained why he didn't do it, and that calculation is a crude political level.
Given my story earlier about my dad's loudspeaker van, you can see why it is I am never sanguine about my capacity to persuade people of things.
Let's talk about, for a few minutes, the inner workings of the BBC and Emily Maitlis last week using a speech to claim that Bobby Gibb was an active agent of the Tory party who interfered with editorial matters. What's your take on this, David? How concerned should we be about the way the BBC is being run?
Okay, let me declare an interest firstly, which is that I do a weekly programme for Radio 4, so I am not as disinterested passive possibly as I need to be. But on the other hand, I'm remarkably well informed about all this. There's been an incredible response to Emily Maitlis one way or another. It is fairly clear to me that Robbie Gibb did intervene in the matter of whether or not Jess Brammer, a woman called Jess Brammer, should be given a senior post at the BBC by attempting to suggest to one of the people making the decision that this would be a bad political move. I think that was absolutely wrong and problematic. And insofar as that's what Emily Maitlis was pointing at, I think she's right. I think she has a point about what happened during the Brexit referendum, which was a really difficult thing for the BBC to call, because, frankly, the notion of balance under those circumstances was difficult. We needed better expert guidance, frankly, on what the consequences were likely to be than a one versus one was likely to give us. I think she's got a point there. There are things where I'm less confident about her position, and I certainly am very unhappy about this becoming some kind of gigantic dichotomy between people who think that the BBC is under the Tory tutelage. By the way, I spend an awful lot of my time dealing with either right-wingers who think that the BBC is left-wing, and there are a lot of those, and left-wingers who think that the BBC is very right-wing, and there are a lot of those. I'm not saying that they're both wrong because they're opposed to each other. I'm just saying it would be quite nice if they would sort it out between the two of them first, come to a decision and tell us which it is, and then we can respond.
Danny?
I think the idea that the BBC is sort of Brexit boosting corporation is absolutely preposterous. And I can't imagine how anyone would get such an idea in their heads. I did think Emily Maitlis's lecture, which was really about the problems that populism poses for journalism, was, and for the BBC, was you know, particularly when groups of politicians say things that are flatly untrue. And you can give an American example of Donald Trump saying the election was stolen, or a British example party arguing that Dominic Cummings had not broken the rules on COVID when he clearly and flatly had. And what do you do in those circumstances? You can't have a balance between truth and lack of truth, or between sense and nonsense. And I think that her lecture was very good in that respect. When it attempted to suggest that or imply that the BBC had sort of become was suborned by the Conservatives and frightened of the government, I just don't think that its output justified that. And indeed, I think the biggest problem for a broadcasting corporation is as the future in this country is increasingly politically between people who have degrees and people who do not. So that is a very big part of it. Then you have to ask yourself the question, how does the BBC quote get qualified people, but also a balanced group?
Daniel Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there. And of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is my chat with Nick Thomas Simmons about what made Harold Wilson a winner.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, a cabinet minister by the age of 31, prime minister at the age of 48, the only post-war PM to win four elections, and the only one to have two separate spells in Downing Street. It was the prime minister who captured the age of the swinging 60s, when Conservative Harold Macmillan looked and sounded like a relic from the 50s. Harold Wilson was the politician who embraced the decade of the Beatles.
I don't care too much for money, money can buy me love.
If you want to see Britain moving ahead and getting ahead, if you want to sweep away outmoded ideas, the old boy network that has condemned so many of our ablest young people to frustration, if you want to see that at every level of our national life, talent and ability are recognised and given their head, then you will feel with us the sense of challenge and of excitement and adventure. For if the past belongs to the Tories, the future belongs to us, all of us. Isn't the choice that we're making this? That we want the children for whom all of us are voting to look back and to say that these were the great days. This was the moment when the people of Britain said, enough is enough. When they decided to take their future and the future of our country into their own hands. This is what we shall be voting about on Thursday.
Yeah, and Harold Wilson won on that Thursday in 1964, thanks in part to party political broadcasts like that one. He then won a landslide and a snap election in 1966, thrown out of office in 1970, but he staged a comeback, winning two elections in February 74 and then again in October that year. No wonder a new book about Harold Wilson is called The Winner, and its author, Labour MP and Shadow International Trade Secretary Nick Thomas Simmons, joins me in the studio. Morning, Nick. Nice to see you. Why Harold Wilson? That's my first question, because there were several other books about Harold Wilson. So what was it that you wanted to get across, explore, examine, discover about Harold Wilson that we perhaps didn't know before?
Well, I think I'm firstly interested in Harold Wilson, as the subtitle suggests, because he won general elections. And since Clem Attlee lost power in 1951, only two Labour leaders so far have actually won general elections, Harold Wilson and Tony Blair. And no Labour leader has won as many times as Harold did. So he's fascinating in that respect. But the reason I think this is the moment for this book is because there were two previous biographies of Harold written in the early 1990s by Ben Pimlott and Philip Ziegler. And perfectly fine books they were, but they were written on the information of the time. So what we have now, we have the government record at the National Archive,
of course, now that have been released.
We have an unpublished autobiography that Harold literally handwrote that I've been able to use for the biography. We've got documents in the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library in the United States that weren't released until the late 1990s. So a lot of new material, but also we are in yet another period of lengthy Labour opposition. So winning a general election is, I think, for Labour, once again, something we need to be seriously considering.
And what did you find? Take me through the process. I'm always sort of fascinated about the process of putting together a biography where the subject is not still alive and lots of the people, you know, in and around the time. But then what did you find in those records and things that you excited you or were new things about Harold Wilson?
What you found in the records in particular were a lot of the private notes that Harold wrote that weren't necessarily made public. And just to give you an example, the 1975 referendum on remaining what was then the common market. And often it said, well, Harold took a bit of a back seat in that. But actually
And that's because he basically let his cabinet split, but in the same way that David Cameron
did. In the same way David Cameron did, he allowed suspension of collective responsibility.
Rose above it, yes. Which basically meant the cabinet was split down the middle almost. Yeah.
Yes. But what he did is you look at every leaflet that went through a door. It's got Harold's name, Harold's face on it, Harold's renegotiation. But also you get to see in the records that the private letters that he was writing. So there was a press conference where Roy Jenkins, who was very much on the side of staying in the common market, making quite critical comments at a press conference about Tony Benn, who was on the other side for coming out. And you get a private letter from Harold almost immediately saying, will you please stop doing this because you are making it more difficult for me to demote Benn after the referendum by behaving in this way. And you see lots of these notes. And what you get the impression of with Harold is always somebody who is in control, far more strategic than the short-term view of him might suggest.
It's interesting, the point you make there is that these days, presumably all that's happening in WhatsApp and text messages and all that, but the fact that it had to be written down and it all goes in the archive and then you can unearth it, you get a sense of what was going through his mind. Clearly, you were talking about the books that came out previously in the 90s, you know, in the run-up to what was then, you know, Tony Blair and winning in 97. And there were lots of parallels, and sometimes these things could be over-egged. But, of course, both Harold Wilson and Tony Blair were the leaders that shouldn't have been the leaders, their predecessors, Hugh Gaitskill in the case of Harold Wilson, John Smith in the case of Tony Blair, died. And the sort of the predecessors had done a lot of work, arguably, to get the party closer to power. And they sort of came and you know, put rocket boosters under it.
They're both completely accidental leaders, both because of quite sudden and shocking deaths of their predecessors. In the case of Harold Wilson, the very sudden and tragic death of Hugh Gaitskill, which opened up a leadership contest, which in other circumstances wouldn't have happened. There was no suggestion that Hugh Gaitskill would have been challenged before the next general election. It was purely that made it possible. But the other thing that it did in both cases was it brought them in as leaders where the Conservatives had already been in power for a substantial period of time. So Harold Wilson becomes Labour leader in February 1963. The Conservatives have been in power since 1951. Macmillan is still the Prime Minister at that stage, but ailing, huge problems, running out of steam. So often timing is everything as well.
Do you think it makes a difference, rather than becoming a leader off the back of a defeat or a challenge, it's sort of, as a new leader, to replace a popular, successful leader of the opposition who died, you know, actually puts you in quite a strong place. It's not trying to pick up the pieces after a crushing election defeat or a... Is there something about those circumstances, do you think? And then actually you have a mandate. It's a sort of positive thing rather than I'm the person best placed to clear up this mess type thing.
It can be, and I think we can also see in those circumstances there's no allegation that somehow the new leader was plotting
exactly,
to bring the previous
what I mean. Yeah,
one
yeah,
down.
The sort of fresher and less
there.
Tainted, yeah.
It's not there. It's a leadership contest that's happened by pure accident and not by design. And clearly that does have an impact. And Harold comes into power at that moment in February 1963. And many, you have to remember, he very wisely included many Gaitskellites yeah. in his shadow cabinet, because they were, not only did he see that in terms of party unity, but there were many people who'd been, you know, extraordinarily close to Hugh Gaitskell, who frankly were still in a real sense of shock and grief.
It's interesting the comparison you make to Macmillan, and I remember interviewing Michael Cockrell a few months ago, and he was making this point that Wilson, Macmillan really struggled with TV, you know, which is the sort of the coming media, if you like. And Wilson really embraced it. You know, we could hear on the TV, on the party political broadcast, you know, his ability to connect down the sort of the camera lens and really look like he was connecting with you. His ability to turn a phrase, and so many of the phrases that he had, we still. Let's take a listen. This was Harold Wilson talking about being a big believer in technology and change.
In terms of the scientific revolution, but that revolution cannot become a reality unless we are prepared to make far-reaching changes in economic and social attitudes which permeate our whole system of society. The Britain that is going to be forged in the white heat of this revolution will be no place for restrictive practices or for outdated methods on either side of industry.
Forged in the white heat, but that still gets used all the time. Yes. Often, but I think some people don't even know where it's sort of come from. It's so part of the lexicon. And then there was also, you know, the pipe, the famous pipe. Mm. Even though he smoked cigars in public, but he knew the pipe was a more appealing image in public.
Yeah,
was it we think of sort of Tony Blair being the most cynical, spin obsessed prime minister ever. Was Wilson the forerunner of that, do you think?
I think that he's actually more authentic, perhaps, than that suggests. But the one thing that I think is fascinating about Harold Wilson is his adaptability, because yeah. you've just played that wonderful clip there, that brilliant White Heat of Technology speech from 1963. But there are also clips of him when he was the president of the Board of Trade between 1947 and 1951. And if you look at those clips on the old British path,
there, yeah.
he's very, very stiff to look
yeah.
at, very
it's
formal,
a
has
person.
A tiny moustache, yeah. still very academic, hasn't quite developed that popular touch. But he was adaptable, and he did develop that popular touch. I think it was Gerald Kaufman who said about him that he almost developed a sense of humour.
Yeah, because
so
he knew there was an advantage to that.
Yes,
so absolutely.
Yeah. And that mastery of the television, he employed a very young television producer called Tony Benn, who trained him as to what you needed to do to be effective on television. Yeah. Of course, one of the things is the quick soundbite. And how many different soundbites, you know, do we remember of things that Harold Wilson said? You know, a week is a long time in politics, he said. You know, the Royal Commissions that governments want to set up, they take minutes and they waste years. You know, there's so many different things that he said, because he always knew that memorable phrase
yeah.
was something that would really assist you in politics.
I don't know how I bring it, because Tony Blair then hired Peter Mandelson, a young TV producer, who did exactly the same thing for him. And so much of the book, and it's a fascinating, it's a great read. It's sort of, you know, there's lots of colour in it. You feel like you can really connect with all the people in it. But so much of the book is occupied with talk of inflation, industrial unrest, strikes, prices, yes. jobs. Are we wrong to keep seeing the parallels today with the 1970s? It feels like, you know, we'll talk a bit about the letters of Keir Starmer, but the sort of the backdrop of what we're living through today is sort of what he was grappling with 50, 60 years ago.
Well, clearly the world and the country's changed, but the dilemma that inflation presents to government is not so different
yeah.
from how it's presented itself to other governments in the past. And Harold, I mean, the one thing that has changed is, of course, the balance of payments in Wilson's day was the great thing by which an economy was measured. Quite frankly, and I say this too as with my international trade hat on, that strong exports was seen as really incredibly important, still are incredibly important and should be today. But that balance of payment statistic, which was a monthly statistic in those days, really was looked
and
at
that's, as that's health exports of the government. Versus imports.
Yes, exactly. And remember as well that we were still in a very different system of currency at this time, the sort of Bretton Woods system where the dollar is the central currency, it's pegged to the value of gold. So you have this constant attack on the currency, and the value of the currency, which is something that runs right through, particularly Wilson's first government.
And do you think, given his because he was off and on Prime Minister over such a long period, clearly he stepped down rather than lose an election, but does he bear responsibility for having not dealt with some of those big structural economic things? We actually did then herald 18 years of Tory rule. It began, you know, beginning with Margaret Thatcher and John Major later, that not dealing with trade unions, not getting on top of inflation, and actually, as the party of the trade union movement, actually, you know, did usher in a period of Margaret Thatcher's actually pretty hardcore dealing with the trade unions.
The thing about this, though, is that I think we're so influenced still by the winter of 1978 and 79. Yeah. Because if you look at, I mean, Jim Callaghan might have won an election if he called in October 1978, and history might be very different. But if you look at Harold Wilson and the problem of inflation in the mid-70s, you get the Yom Kippur War, you get OPEC quadrupling the value of a barrel of oil overnight. So you get this huge inflation that goes into the economy and everything that goes with it. But if you look at 1975, Harold had started to get inflation under control. August 75, we talk about it as a difficult period. Harold was still ahead in the polls in August 1975. And I think we tend to judge him with the hindsight. We tend to judge him. It's almost like a history won by the written by the victors situation, because of we know what happened in the 1980s. But of course, he didn't know in 1975, 76.
So that's where it was going, yeah.
But if you look at the various things that he tried to do, the very interventionist approach to try and bring about solutions to strikes, or indeed the social contract, which provides not just the method by which he wanted to manage industrial relations in the 70s, but things that have stood the test of time. Things like the Health and Safety at Work Act, which is Harold Wilson. Things like the Employment Protection Act, which brought in maternity leave for the first time. You know, ACAS, the conciliation body in employment law today, still here. That's Harold Wilson again in the mid-70s. So some pretty far-reaching reforms as well.
And on the social side, there were lots of things as well: equality legislation, decriminalisation of homosexuality, the abolition of capital punishment, race relations acts. Some have argued that actually he was all tactics and no strategy, and actually some of those things were things that were other people's idea. He was the one who sort of picked them up and ran them. I mean, you're clearly a fan of his, so I suspect you'll say that actually that's, you know, it's all credit to him that happened. I mean, or was it just timing? That things happened and he was the one who was there to implement it?
Well, the thing is, when things go wrong in government, prime ministers carry the can, right? Quite rightly, because that's where the buck stops. Yeah. But when things go right, we have to look at the prime minister of the time as well.
You're allowed to take the credit for the good stuff.
But it's also about, I think, recognising with these things. Wilson himself was a social conservative. He had this great congregationalist background. Mm. But he did think the changes were necessary. They came about, he is the one who appointed Roy Jenkins to be Home Secretary in December 1965, knew he had a liberal reforming agenda. Things did come about, like, for example, the Abortion Act is David Steele, the decriminalisation of homosexuality is Leo Absey. They did come about through backbenchers, Sidney Silverman in terms of the death penalty. But in that period from 1964 to late 1967, the three dominant figures in that government were James Callaghan, George Brown, and Harold Wilson. Both Callaghan and Brown had very serious doubts as to why the government was giving time to things that they didn't think were the responsibility of government. If Harold had wanted to put a stop to all of it, he could have done it very easily. It was his decision not to do that that actually meant that the reforms
took place. Those things happened. We need to talk about Marcia Williams, because people can't think of Harold Wilson without thinking about Marcia Williams. Put it into context. I mean, I was sort of, when I was reading, I was thinking, it's sort of a Dominic Cummings character. Sort of, it's more than Alistair Campbell. It wasn't just spin. It was it was everything that she was involved in his political life.
Yeah, she's a remarkable figure, and I argue in the book that before Margaret Thatcher, she probably came closer to the centre of power in Number 10 than any other woman, in my view. I think that there were certain things she gave Harold, I think, were absolutely vital to him and what he was. And I think the first was the adaptability, Matt, that we've discussed previously. Who was the person above all that helped him transform from that very formal academic president of the Board of Trade to the person with the popular touch in the early 60s? Yeah. It was Marcia Williams. It was Marcia Williams, the one person, he could give her a speech, she'd write rubbish across it. And she used to say to him, if I can't understand it, Harold, the public can't understand it, you need to completely rewrite it so people can understand it. She was a big... The second thing she did is, you know, the top of politics can be a very lonely place. And what she did was support him with 100% loyalty, even to the extent that when he left in 1976, she went with him.
Yeah.
You know, she stayed. You would still find, I mean, people... I interviewed John Tomlinson, who's in the House of Lords, who was Harold's PPS. And he remembered ringing up, I think it was one of the European election campaigns in the 80s, to ring Harold's office, see if Harold would come and campaign for him. Marcia answered the phone.
Yeah.
She's still there, still loyal.
Yeah.
And those two things, I think, that she gives him are vital to understanding him.
But her presence there caused incredible tensions. The most amazing story involving Harold Wilson's doctor, Joe Stone.
Yeah, I mean, the 1970s government, and I interviewed other members of his inner circle, including, I was delighted to interview Joe Haynes many times, who was his press secretary. And the 1970s stories of the instability, if you like, around Marcia Williams are quite remarkable, to the extent that it appears, not entirely as a joke, that Dr. Stone had suggested she might be, in inverted commas, put down because of the pressure that was being brought to bear on Harold. Now, you can take that story as you wish, one way or another, but that the story is, I think, even told is indicative of the tensions that by then existed.
And it's amazing, because the story that basically the idea of bumping her off has persisted and has come from so many sources. The very fact it was even being discussed is absolutely, absolutely extraordinary. Still joined by Nick Thomas-Simmons, Labour MP and Shadow International Trade Secretary, discussing his book, The Winner, but it's all about Harold Wilson, with a quote on the cover from Keir Starmer. Puts Harold Wilson in his rightful place, a fine work of history, it says. Keir Starmer said that Harold Wilson is his favourite Prime Minister of all time. Do you think that's because of the election victories or because he ran from the left and ended up betraying them afterwards?
Well, the number of Labour leaders who've been accused of being betrayers is probably more than I can count. But I think that Harold is somebody, when we talk about the winner, clearly he is an electoral winner, and that's just incontestable. I mean, look at the post-1945. Yeah. There's not a leader of either party who's won four times. It's a remarkable thing to do. But that winning was not simply about elections. It was about doing things and achieving things. If he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have kept winning. And I think it's that sense of power for a purpose that Harold really does embody. And we've discussed some of the changes that he made, Matt, but it's an extensive list that he's bequeathed to us today that still affect our society today.
Reading it, one thing that leapt out in terms of, you know, if Keir Starmer was reading this, you're talking here about his instincts and what he wanted, particularly in his speeches. This is Harold Wilson speaking. Remember that I don't want too many of those guardianisms, environmentalism, generalism, genderism, etc. I want my speeches always to include what working people are concerned with: jobs, pay, prices, pensions, homes, kids, schools, health. You included that as a little note to your leader. Less guardianisms and more of the stuff that people care about.
Well, what Harold is talking about there, that's something he said to the person who became head of his policy unit, Bernard Donoghue, in 1974. And what Harold is saying there is pretty common sense, really. He's saying, talk about the bread and butter issues. And if you think about today, the issue that dominates all other, quite rightly, is the cost of living crisis. And it's coming up with practical things that make a difference. And that's precisely, whether it's windfall tax, whether it's the energy price freeze, that's exactly what we've been trying to do.
Do you think that looking at the scale of the ambition of Harold Wilson before he gets into office and then what he achieved, do you think that Keir Starmer needs to up his game a bit and sort of think a bit bigger? I mean, you talk about the energy bills, you know, he's basically adopted a Lib Dem policy of freezing the price cap. It's not, you know, you don't get the sense of ambition that you get from reading this book.
Well, the price cap was originally Ed Miliband's idea, actually, rather than the Lib Dems. And I remember a lot of criticism at the time, but it seems to everybody accepts it now across our politics. But In terms of what's interesting about this is that we've played the excellent clip of the White Seat of Technology.
Yeah.
And the one area where clearly technology is going to make a huge difference, whether you're talking about AI, many other things in our lives in the next 10, 15 years, even before that. But clearly in climate technology, that's going to be an absolutely huge thing. Yeah. And we've actually got a climate investment pledge of £28 billion each and every year. You talk about ambition, that is a pretty ambitious pledge that we have to transform.
So what's lacking there? Is it the fray? Is it the selling? Is it the climate investment pledge isn't as good as the White Heat of Technology? That's the... Is that the thing that Keir Starmer's lacking sometimes? There's a lot of thinking that goes on, but communicating that with the public doesn't always seem to quite land.
But I think that is more to do with, in opposition, you have to repeat things. Remember that there is a difference these days between the era that Harold and in the 70s. I mean, you think, for example, that there was once a situation when I was growing up, there were essentially four television channels, right? So if you had a political leader who went on to one of the four channels at peak time, you are speaking to millions of people, right? Now, I often join Times Radio on the what we call the morning media round. I think it's about 11 or 12 interviews in the mornings these days. So I think in opposition in particular, especially during the pandemic, actually having to do that repetition, I think it's more difficult now to get that instant hit. And clearly that's what Harold did with the White Heat of Technology.
So do you think Keir Starmer's got what it takes to be the winner?
I think Keir Starmer is going to be the third Labour leader since 1951 to win a general election. I think it's going to be Harold Wilson, Tony Blair, Keir Starmer in the 2020s. And, you know, I've known Keir for many years, known Keir before. Obviously, he was the leader of the party. And I've always believed, that's why I backed him to be the leader, that he has what it takes to be Prime Minister. I think he will be.
And what does he need to do? You've got party conference coming up. What do you want to see from Keir Starmer? You know, new Prime Minister, may well get a bit of a honeymoon bounce and all of that. What does he need to do with that party conference, do you think? Do we need to see some flesh on the bones a bit?
Well, I think we're already seeing that. I mean, we are the ones who've put forward what we would be doing about the cost of living crisis. And I think what we'll see from Keir at the party conference is this, that he's said in previous conference speeches that we had a mountain to climb, and that's true. But I think we're going to be seeing more and more of, when you get to the top of the mountain, what you can actually see. And I think that's what we're going to get from Keir Starmer this autumn.
And you're likely to have a new Tory opponent, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, your current opponent in International Trade Secretary. Who do you think you'll get next? Are you concerned about the new incoming government?
I'm worried more than concerned in terms of the paucity of the debate that we've had over the summer. There seems to be a slightly unreal quality about the debate in comparison to what I'm seeing in my inbox and what I'm getting in my constituency every time I'm out talking to people and realising the pressures. And it seems we've got these two parallel realities going on of this debate between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, which doesn't seem to bear a great deal of resemblance to what's actually going on. Who is my opponent? I've shadowed many people over the years. I look forward to yet another opponent. Each person that I've shadowed has had their own strengths and weaknesses, and I look forward to whoever it is, whether Anne-Marie carries on or someone else.
And what do you make of Liz Truss not doing this interview tonight? In fact, not doing any interviews?
Well, if she doesn't believe that her plan can survive 30 minutes with Nick Robinson, how on earth does she think it's going to actually survive when it hits reality in the autumn? I find it quite astonishing.
Well, we've invited on her as well. She's not taken up our offer either. Nick, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for coming in. Harold Wilson, the winner, is out this week. And it's a great read. If you're interested, I mean, you know, if you're listening to this show, you know that we're interested in politics and history and stuff as well. But it's full of loads of great stories and colour and late nights and drink and shouting and all of that. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times. And this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.